ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Ann Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Even if you love a sunburnt country, the heat of the past few summers has probably got to you. It turns out we're changing our holiday habits due to the heat, according to new research. What does that mean for the future of tourism? Also ahead, as we've been reporting this morning, country music legend Dolly Parton has died, aged 80. Her impact was enormous, not just in her music, but in literacy too. Her Imagination Library provided books to children all over the world, including here in Australia. More on that soon. Plus, backyard birds. What does the threat of H5 bird flu mean for your regular avian visitors? Could putting a plate of seeds out for them to gather at actually put them at risk? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, my husband and I were the first on both our sides of our families to have kids, which meant that our eldest was absolutely venerated by two sets of grandparents, aunts, and uncles. And there was something a little bit smug about being the first to become parents because we had experience that our siblings couldn't relate to. But then the others eventually started having babies, and I realized they'd all had an experience that I'd had to wait for. I was finally an auntie. And the day I met my nephew, my little sister's son, for the first time, less than a day old, was a revelation. He was a tiny human who was my flesh and blood. He was precious and perfect and a little bit mine, but without the compulsory nighttime waking and nappy changes. And I think it must be a little bit what it feels like to become a grandparent. Being an auntie or an uncle is such a special relationship, but maybe it's one we don't value as much as we should. So today, an ode to the aunties and uncles. And I would love to hear from you about what you love about being an auntie or an uncle, who you're trying to be in that relationship. And eminently qualified to weigh in on this topic, Auntie Kate Lever and Uncle Tiger Webb. Kate and Tiger, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much.
Hi.
So, Kate, you recently wrote a beautiful ode to auntiehood. So you say it's something you were born to do. Tell me about your quote-unquote feral devotion bordering on obsession.
I'm so pleased you chose that quote. Thank you so much. I've decided not to be a mother, and which was a painful process of indecision for me, but it was a real revelation when I realized that I'm meant to be an auntie, and it just feels like the right role in my life, and there's nothing I treasure more than being Auntie Katie. So my little sister has two little girls who are 6 and 4. Their names are Poppy and Bonnie, and they are the light of my life. They are cheeky, weird, gorgeous. You know, I'm devoted to them, as I said, in a feral way that borders on obsession. I cried yesterday afternoon because one of them was going through something, you know, that would be described as a minor inconvenience. I understand finally what it means when parents say it's like wearing your heart outside of your body. You know, yeah. I just really love them.
That's so, so beautiful. And Tiger, you've been an uncle since you were 8. I'm wondering if maybe your experience with your at least first niece or nephew was a little different to what Kate's describing.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of co-conspirators, co-children at that age. I think I was about 10 or 11 when the first one came along. And so it's, you know, it's kind of playground trivia. Oh, you know, I'm an uncle. And then people look at you kind of askance, really? How? You know, the years go by and I've managed to become an uncle to children where the age gap is a little bit more sensical, shall we say. So two very different experiences, I think, of uncledom. I hope I've been able to sort of help a bit more the second, well, really sort of third or fourth time around than the first couple.
With this niece or nephew that came along when you were an adult, do you sort of, was it kind of that feeling of going like, oh, this is what people talk about? This is what people like Kate talk about?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's a very different experience. Like for me, the biggest thing about it, particularly when they're that young, like when they get older, and now they're sort of the oldest, this guy's the big rig, Rory is seven. You know, it's a bit different now, but back then it's like, I think principally it's just for me something that I was surprised at how close it may be to then have kids. We kind of went, it's just sort of shared vocabulary, something to talk about. Obviously, I'm profoundly interested in the lives of the big rig and Mad Margaret, his little sister. So, you know, you can, whatever else, you know, parenthood can do and uncledom and auntiedom can do, it does provide this like shared thing that's just always in your life that's material to talk about, you know, how they're going at school, what are they doing for book week, you know, yeah, they're still loving them, their little maths, you know, they've got some funny questions for you, Uncle Tiger, about language, can you answer them? Me, probably not. So it's that constant contact and relationship with the sibling, I think, is actually the most profound part of it, at least for now.
So, Kate, before you became an auntie, were you thinking much about that as being one of the roles you would eventually play?
Do you know what? I hadn't given it a lot of thought, mainly because it's so dependent on someone else's life choices. You know, I had to wait until my sister was ready to have children herself. And I was kind of preoccupied, I think, you know, because of social conditioning and expectations and all of that. I just always deeply assumed that I would become a mum because it's just sort of something a lot of people do. And so it wasn't till I think I was in my early 30s and I realized I didn't want to go along that route. And then my sister, bless her, got pregnant. And I was like, hang on a second. Now this could really work for me. And it's not something I think I'd sort of thought, yeah, I guess one day I'll become an auntie when my sister does her thing. But then I realized that being an auntie could be like a much bigger and more important and more central role for me than I'd ever sort of realized before. And that's meant a lot for me because, you know, I think I went to stay with my sister when she had her second. So there was a newborn and a toddler in the house. And anyone who's experienced that knows it's complete mayhem. Mm. And my sister sort of said to me, does this make you more sure than ever that you've made the right decision not to have kids? And I know what she meant because, you know, the house was a mess. It was loud. But I knew about all of that already. I'd thought about that in great detail. But I said yes, but it was more because, and I said this to her, it's more because the only thing I've worried about in not becoming a parent myself is that I am a very loving person and I do love children, you know. My first job was being a professional fairy, a children's entertainer. I've always loved children and there's something very childlike about me. And I just said to my sister that day, you know, now I know where to put all my love. Her little girls can have it all and they will. And maybe one day they'll be overwhelmed by it. But it's very important to me to be their backup, safe grown-up, you know, and their friend.
Absolutely. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to a former professional fairy, Kate Lever, also a journalist, and the ABC's editorial policies advisor for language, Tiger Webb, also a veteran uncle, about the joy of auntie and unclehood. And I'd really love to hear your story about what you love about being an auntie or an uncle. Kelly, I want you to tell me about when you became an auntie.
So I was three. I just turned three when I became an auntie for the first time. And 2 weeks later, I became an auntie again. So I had a nephew and a niece. And I guess I was very aware that I was their auntie. But in reality, we did very much grow up like siblings. We got all the fun, I guess, of being siblings. But then they'd go home and I'd have mum and dad to myself again. And it's just been, I've got 12 nephews and nieces in total. Most of them have had children as well. Yeah.
I'm thinking about your kids, Kelly, and how your nieces and nephews might be more like aunts and uncles to them.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And so it's really lovely now. Like we actually live, you know, at least about 9 hours from most of my family, but they're in New South Wales and I'm in Victoria. But when we get back there, my kids have all my nieces and nephews, who are, very much sort of my age to 27. I'm 48. They go down to 27. And so they've got these lovely young adults who are really cool and fun and, you know, get to play, you know, they play guitar with them or have them on their shoulders when we're out hiking. And then my great nieces and nephews are there for them as this huge big bunch of kids to play with. So it's, you know, spotlight in the dark when once we've finished dinner, or they're doing TikTok dances out on the veranda, or, you know, they just have this great big bunch of people that that they can play with.
Kelly, that sounds gorgeous. It sounds noisy, not unlike my own extended family. So Tiger, Kelly's family sounds quite complicated. We might not wade too much into that, but you are our language advisor here at the ABC. Where do you stand on the word nibbling?
Look, fine with it. It feels a useful gap, being a gender-neutral term for that kind of familial relationship. I'd appreciate some people might not like it that much, but I don't get too fired up about that kind of thing. I quite like, always, you know, men are such the beneficiaries of language here, but I like unk too, even though I don't really qualify. I'm a bit too old to be using the term, but it was funny, you know, thinking about all of the ways where, like, the words that usually appear before uncle in, like, English discourse are crazy, you know, weird or racist, sometimes rich. It's historically been maybe not the best impression in the English language or the best connotation for uncles, a bit like stepmothers, really. And then you finally ever get this sort of this unk contraction, which is a bit cooler and a bit used by the youth, if only to signal how out of touch and daggy I am, which I'm completely fine with.
It's like unk is, it's unk does, I guess. You're listening to Life Matters. You're sending me your text as well as giving me a call. In Asia, most, Chris says, in Asia, most regular adult friends of a family are automatically called uncle by the children. So after 30 plus years, I have been uncle and am still uncle to hundreds of kids who themselves are now parents and probably uncles. That one is from Uncle Chris. Richard says, one of the sad aspects of being an aunt or an uncle is that once these kids grow up and build a life separate from their parents, they become distant. You can necessarily slide down their priority list and you rarely, maybe never see them. Kate, is this something that keeps you up at night?
Yes, a little bit. But I also just, I just don't believe that it'll happen. I mean, maybe I'm naive and maybe it will, but I think I plan on having an adult relationship with my adult nieces as they grow up. And I hope they'll deign to still be in my life. I imagine them being in my life all along. And so I'm going to think of that as being what will happen until, you know, informed otherwise. I imagine there'll be a difficult period when they're teenagers, when they might not think I'm the coolest person to hang out with. But I also hope
you'll be
that
cooler
they might
than
call
their
me.
Mum, don't worry.
Oh yeah, well, I'm hoping they might call me if they go to a party they're not meant to be at or get in trouble and they don't want to call their parents. I'm hoping I'm the person who could swoop in then and, you know, be backup emergency adult. But yeah, I don't like to think of a time when they won't be in my lives because I just don't think that's going to happen for me. But I appreciate that it does.
Kate, if it's any consolation, I drove down the Gold Coast on the weekend to catch up with two of my aunties who I still call Auntie Margie and Auntie Lou. Greg has called in. Greg, you are an uncle, but you also have a special uncle in your life too. Can you tell me about Uncle Keith?
Yes, Uncle Keith. And it seems like quite a few people, including your one of your producers, has an Uncle Keith as well. I think the special thing, and something you maybe your guests will touch on, is that, and I think your guest just did mention that about stepping in when other parents or the parents can't, is that as an adult, particularly if you had an interesting relationship with the parent, they can fill in a lot of blanks in the parent's life as a child or growing up before children. And I think it's really absolutely invaluable in understanding and developing our relationship with our parent, be they alive or dead, and how we resolve issues, if that's the case. Not to say that I personally, because I have had two wonderful parents. My late father was a fantastic guy. But Uncle Keith was able to share really great stories of my father and his other brothers growing up in Western Australia around Perth and so forth, both pre-Second World War and post-Second World War. And that, I think, was invaluable to understand my father and how he evolved as an adult, as a human being, as opposed to being a parent. And I think often if you don't have that opportunity to have that, I think sometimes, you know, not to say we all make up gaps in our lives, but you could be a little bit poorer for it.
Yeah, you get that that context for your parent. That's a really interesting perspective. Vivi's called in. Vivi, tell me about the special relationship you have with your niece.
Firstly, I have to tell you that I'm 82 years young. So it's an adult relationship now because my niece is in her early 40s. I only had one child and my sister only had one child, and this niece is her one child. And I was not that involved with her when she was young because I was actually living overseas. But when she was a young adult and wanting to study to become a nurse, she stayed with me for a while, which was beautiful. But now at this point in time, she is my go-to person. She's such a wonderful, caring, support person. And although she has a family of her own, a husband and two children and a very high-powered job, she always has time for me, and it's just a wonderful relationship.
That is beautiful, Vivi. Thank you so much for the call. You're really all blowing my phone up wanting to talk to me about being an aunt or an uncle. Matthew, you're an uncle, and the relationship has shifted over the generations.
Yeah. Hi, Tegan. I'm now a great uncle. Which is
I'm sure
wonderful.
You're a great, great uncle, Matthew.
In fact, the three-year-old is enjoying the GGG, the great gay uncle, the gunkle, and she laughs at that. I think the point I was making was that, you know, it's been an insight or a window onto the different generations. I've got a nephew and two nieces who are now in their 20s at university in the UK, all doing very different things. I've now got the great niece. Sadly, I lost my nephew, the great niece's father, who never made it to 40 with cancer, which was a big loss. But the fact that one lives on with his widow and the great niece and get to see, you know, all of these wonderful characteristics I know well of my nephew coming to shine through is quite special.
Matthew, thank you so much for the call. Tiger, you were an uncle from way back, as you said before. You since have had kids of your own. How's that shifted that relationship for you guys?
It's been wonderful. I mean, you know, it's one of the best things that you can do in a way. Well, hopefully, I say optimistically, but you're providing my nephew and niece with, I hope, a friend for life. And, you know, quite a high quality one. Most people my age, you know, grew up with lots of cousins and the cousins may have been of, you know, for some people of variable quality, or the age gaps might have prevented, you know, real and fast firm friendships forming. But, you know, in general, they love one another and they can't get enough of cousin time and hanging out. So, you know, I hope that continues. And I see, of course, like any familial or parenting experience, you see the reflections of what came before you. But, you know, the deep sense of happiness and contentedness you get with this idea that you are, you know, pushing them, nudging them towards this thing that in 30, 40 years' time, they'll be able to, you know, reminisce about their games of Spotlight or Tip or, you know, park time, whatever it was, you know, riding their bikes together. That is so wonderful and satisfying and makes you very, very chuffed. It's fair to say, very uncle word there, chuffed.
Oh, yeah, cousins are a true gift, except for when they're not, but then they quickly become a gift again. Katrina's called in. Katrina, you've formed a special bond with your niece. What does being an auntie mean to you?
I think everything. I think, as Matthew just quite rightly said, it's a friend for life. I've got a young nephew, but I've got a nephew and niece that I do spend a bit of time with. They do live in regional Queensland. So, you know, the beauty of technology is that we keep up on family WhatsApp and FaceTime and things like that. But it's a friend for life. I try not to provide too much unsolicited advice to them. But, you know, if they come to me and they're looking for advice, I talk to them about their careers. I talk to them about their relationships. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of them all and I just love them so much.
Shout out to your nieces and nephews, Katrina. Thank you so much for the call. Kate, you say the role of an auntie or uncle is overlooked and undervalued. What do you think needs to change?
I just think, do you know what? It's not that I think uncles and aunties need, you know, a round of applause for their role. It's more that I think, like, I think the way modern parenting is in a way broken, with childcare being so expensive and, you know, the split of labour between people. And we talk so much about how it takes a village to raise children, and yet we don't actually speak about who those members of the village might be and how important they might be, and also how important it might be to be a villager. Mm-hmm. You know, to more than anything, I just sort of want to encourage people who do get the opportunity to be an auntie or an uncle or a non-binary bonus lovely adult in someone's life to think about more intentionally about what kind of auntie and uncle they want to be, and also to lean into the beauty and the joy of that role, and lucky we are to get to do that. And also I do think, yeah, I mean, I think we're in an epidemic of loneliness. It's a very difficult time to be bringing children up with the state of the world. I just think we should be sort of really appreciating and cultivating those relationships with as many loving adults as we possibly can for our children. And, you know, I don't consider myself child-free. I consider myself child-adjacent. Mm. And I think there are a lot of people, I just think, you know, celebrate the members of the village we hear so much about needing to raise children.
Well, I'll give you a round of applause anyway. Kate, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Kate Lever, journalist, author, doting auntie, former professional fairy, and Tiger Webb, editorial policy advisor here at the ABC, and a loving uncle since he was a wee boy himself. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, the legacy of a very famous auntie, Dolly Parton. One of her many nephews was the one to announce the news of her death a few hours ago. Part of her legacy was her imagination library, which provided books to kids all over the world, including here in Australia. This morning, we have been reflecting on the legacy of country music legend Dolly Parton, who died overnight aged 80. And she won so many accolades, but said one of her proudest achievements was establishing her imagination library. It began as an idea to distribute free books to students in her hometown in East Tennessee, but it grew into a worldwide program that has donated more than 300 million books since its inception. And while Dolly was here in Australia touring in 2011, she explained what it meant to her.
My own father, who's one of the smartest people I ever knew, was from a family of about 15 kids. So they had to start working. My dad didn't get a chance to go to school. So he was so very proud of me when I started the program. He got to live long enough to see that all doing really well. And he was prouder of the fact that the little kids called me the book lady than the fact that I'd worked so hard to become a star.
The book lady. Well, here with me to have a chat about the legacy of this program is Lindsay McKee, CEO of United Way, which runs the Imagination Library here in Australia. Lindsay, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much, Tegan. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to share some more about the legacy of Dolly Parton.
So how did this program make its way all the way to Australia?
Yeah, like it's an incredible global program. It's in four other countries. And in 2013, we just saw the advantage and the opportunity of actually bringing what was a global program with great evidence behind it to our Australian children and families. So since 2013, we have been working with lots of incredible partners and funders to roll this out. And we have now 50,000 children, Australian children, enrolled on this program, and they're getting beautiful, high-quality Australian books, and as well as much-loved books that we all know and love from our childhoods, and they're getting that directly into the home every month.
So it actually started in Tamworth, and last year I spoke to some of the Tamworth parents. We were talking about the program back then, and they told me what the program meant to them. Here is one of the parents we spoke to.
Personally, I came from books, so it was quite easy for me to jump in, but my partner, he never read a book for the last like 10 years, so it was great for him just to know what to pick up and really connect with her in a way as well too.
Is that a common reflection, Lindsay?
Yeah, the great thing, Tegan, we hear, you know, we wrote this program out to really support early literacy and parent child bonding and parent caregiver bonding. But we've also realized there's incredible other outcomes around parents' literacy and adult literacy improving. We've heard librarians telling us they're getting more children accessing libraries. We're hearing from allied health nurses that reach more families because we're into the homes of more families in Australia through this beautiful, trusted, joyful program. So the ripple of impacts that we're seeing are pretty incredible.
You didn't need to be Dolly Parton that brought this program. Sending books around is something that could have happened anyway. What is it about her specifically that makes this legacy special?
Yeah, look, I don't know how much you know about her, Tegan. I've been doing many deep dives around Dolly. You know, I'm an absolute fan of her. She's just an absolute legend musically as a songwriter, but also in her philanthropy and, you know, her vision for education and access to education for so many. And we knew by bringing this program, the wonderful thing about it, it's such a high dosage. It's 60 books into the home over those first 5 years, which are the most important years of brain development for children. So we knew there was this really successful model that was working with that we thought we could actually bring in leverage. And what we do is we work with many wonderful Australian partners, academics, authors, publishers, to really make sure we put a stamp on it that makes it very much Australian, but leverages the incredible global foundation that Dolly and her team have set up.
Will it be continuing now that she's gone?
Yes, which is wonderful. It's this is very much part of Dolly's legacy, and the way that the foundation have been set up, it's very much we want to keep on rolling this out. There's 3 million children every month globally who are getting this book. And as I said, 50,000 in Australia. And certainly at United Way, we want to continue to support more children and families have access to this.
Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Lindsay McKee, CEO of United Way, which runs Dolly Parton's Imagination Library in Australia. And thank you for your tributes to Dolly on the text line. Dee says, we had a dress-up party a few weeks ago where you had to show up as someone beginning with the letter our name began with. Thank you for the honour and the privilege, Dolly. You may be gone, but not forgotten. Rest in peace. Dee has attached a photo of her dressed up as Dolly Parton. Another says, we will always love you, Dolly. Well, it's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Next, this Northern Hemisphere summer has been punishingly hot, which is a real mood killer if you were planning to look glamorous on your Euro trip. The summer looming here could be just as bad. What does it mean for your travel plans and for the tourism industry? Right now, a little bit north of you, Europe is in the thick of summer. And if you are not freshly tanned from visiting those northern climes yourself, your social media feed is probably full of people who are. But behind the perfect beaches and melting gelato are wildfires and heat waves. They're becoming so significant, we're altering our travel plans. There's new research that shows that a fifth of people surveyed had changed their most recent holiday because of the weather. We're seeing extreme weather events around the world. They're hitting at times when most people would be thinking of travelling. In Europe, authorities are calling this fire season the worst in modern history. And our own Aussie summer is predicted to be a scorcher with a strong El Nino building. So how will heat and extreme weather impact our travel plans and maybe the patterns of tourism into the future? We're about to hear from a couple of people with thoughts on this, but I'd love to hear from you if you've made changes to holiday plans due to the weather. Is there maybe a trip you used to take every year that you have pushed to a different time? Well, one of the co-authors of this new research is Stephen Garnett. He's a professor of conservation and sustainable livelihoods at Charles Darwin University. Stephen, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
Tell me about what your research found.
So we did a national survey of about 2,000 people, and you mentioned that 20% had changed their plans. Now, about 6% was because of rain, and that was expected. People don't like rain. A slightly larger group was because of natural disasters like fire or flood, sort of climate-driven things. That was 8%. But the surprise to us was that the last holiday affected 6% of people because of the heat. They changed something because it was just too hot for them.
I mean, we're pretty used to hot weather here in Australia. What surprised you most about these findings?
Well, exactly that. We're used to heat. We expect heat. You plan for heat. You know it's going to be hot and sunny on the beach. So people are saying, well, it's just too hot. Mm. I can't stand it. I'm going to do something else.
Were you looking at Australian tourism only or international as well?
About 30% of people had taken their last holiday overseas, in mostly to Asia, over half to Asia. What was it, about 20% to Europe, 10% New Zealand. But there wasn't much difference, actually, in the effects of heat between any of those things on the tourism decisions.
Right, so it really is tourism across the board. Well, also here with us is Anne Hardy, who's an adjunct professor in the Hotel School at Southern Cross University. And when you heard about this new research from Stephen, what did you make of it?
Oh, good morning. Yeah, look, it's really fascinating. And I think that this research is underpinning a lot of conversations that are happening in the tourism industry worldwide at the moment, because we're starting to see people changing what they do, as Stephen had said, and what that is doing is it's impacting the tourism industry. So we're starting to see people have substitutions, going to places because it's too hot, or even changing what they do during the day. So the kind of movements, the mobility and the temporal dimensions of tourism are changing. They might be doing things earlier in the morning and later at night, or if it's too much, they're changing their plans completely. And that brings a host of, impact and infrastructure needs to the tourism industry.
Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, so at the moment, well, most recently what we've seen in Spain, for example, over the summer is, I believe that many people have gone down to Spain for the coast, and it's just been so warm that they've started to go up into the villages and spend their time up there. But the villages behind the coast don't necessarily have the tourism infrastructure which is needed for tourists. They may not have good roads, enough public toilets, enough restaurants, that type of thing. So that, and also the villages may not always want to have tourism in them. So that sort of substitution effect has happened quite suddenly. And for some destinations, it sort of caught them unawares.
It feels like there might be some winners and some losers here.
Yeah, look, there are. I mean, there's always, there's always winners and losers. And the thing about tourism is it's a trend and it reacts to things. So, places, some of the ironic thing is that some of the losers because of the environment, if we want to call it that, such as the Great Barrier Reef or, say, Antarctica, they're finding that a lot of people go there now because they know they're losing. They want to go there before they disappear. Right. And we call that last chance travel. So, yes, there's an irony that, just like we've seen with Dolly Parton, as soon as something becomes rare or perhaps it's about to end or in her case ended, rest in peace, then people start to want to go there or revisit that place.
Mm. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Anne Hardy from Southern Cross University and Stephen Garnett from Charles Darwin University about climate and weather shifting our travel plans. Stephen is the co-author of a new study showing that a fifth of the people that they surveyed said that they'd made changes to their most recent holiday because of the weather. If you've had that experience, if you've made changes to your travel plans, I'd love to know about it. Jason says, I just got back from 4 weeks in Italy and wouldn't go back at this time of year again. Too hot. Well, Anne, I'm interested to know whether we're seeing this in Australia's tourism offerings.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we are starting to see it. We're starting to see people get, for example, I'm in Tasmania, so we're starting to see an increasing interest in cool weather tourism. That's a worldwide phenomenon. So Tasmania is taking advantage of that. But we're also starting to see the impacts on the industry. So over the last 2 years in the east coast of Tasmania in a town called Bishanoe, it's well known for its penguin population. And over the last couple of years, around the summer, 1 year it was December, this year it happened I think in February, the water warmed up and suddenly the birds that had little chicks, they disappeared. So the chicks were left unfed. And we're not 100% sure, but it seems that it correlated at the same time with a very sudden warming in the temperature of the water. And the birds were forced, the penguins were forced to go right out to sea to try and find food. And they didn't return for a much longer period of time. So we're seeing some, very worrying things about the product or our wildlife and our environment. And we're also seeing worrying things in terms of the fact that this increased risk from climate change is increasing insurance premiums. And this is a massive issue in tourism at the moment.
Yeah, so all of those knock-on effects coming through as well. You're telling me your altered travel plans. John says, we used to ride the Murray to the Mountains Rail Trail as a family, but the threat of wildfires and the inability to outrun a firefront on a bike means we can no longer consider this as an option. And Richard in Newcastle says, I visit my brother in Europe. I'd prefer to visit in the cooler months, but he always encourages me to visit in the months with longer daylight hours so we can do more outdoors in the evening. Sort of getting it from both ends there. Stephen, where do you predict this going in the future?
It's going to be a mix. I think people will adapt. The tourism industry will adapt. I think that people will learn to live with heat. But yeah, it's going to be shifting behaviours when people go to places. There's going to be new products. There's going to be new locations, cooler locations. It's going to be really interesting to see which things are selected for and which aren't. Mm. As this changes, it's coming at us regardless. We can't stop it now. And we're going to have to adapt to it.
So, Anne, what do you see those adaptations looking like in Australia?
Yeah, I think Stephen's right. I think adaptations might be that people will start to go to different places. And I think they'll also go at different times. So recently there was an article, I think, in the ABC, which was very interesting to me, which was about the morning economy and how there's this increase in, you know, people buying, purchasing and doing things in Australia in the cooler hours. So I think we'll see changes in terms of what people will do during the day. And we also might see, tourists are risk averse. They do worry about risk. And I think that will have impacts on, you know, what people do when they do it and where they do it as well.
Well, Stephen, and thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Stephen Garnett is Professor of Conservation and Sustainable Livelihoods at Charles Darwin University. He co-wrote the study we've been talking about with Professor Kirsten Sander, and Anne Hardy is an adjunct professor in the Hotel School at Southern Cross University. And you're sending me your text as well. Terry says, I would recommend not travelling to Canada with the idea of travelling through the Rocky Mountains in their fall due to smoke haze and poor scenic visibility. Another says, we've changed our ski holiday plans in recent years. Previously, we would go in mid-August. Now we are going in June if there is an early dump, or mid to late July, as by August, it's often too warm and the snow is melting. Never go in the July school holidays anymore. This year, it was 15 degrees during the day, literally t-shirt weather, at the top of the mountain, not exactly skiing weather. Well, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, do you feed the birds that visit your backyard? About a half of Australian households do. What does the spread of bird flu mean for these backyard beauties that you're having your cup of tea with in the morning? Is there a bird feeder hanging in your backyard? Do you have some special feathered friends who'll come up and eat right out of your hand? even though the experts say we shouldn't feed wild birds, about half of Australian households do. But we might need to put backyard bird feeding on hold for a bit, or at least change the way we do it, because there's a risk it could be a hotspot for bird flu transmission. More on that in a moment. You'll also hear what other practical things you can do to help. But I'm very keen to hear who comes to visit your bird feeder. Have you formed a special relationship with the birds you feed? Tell me about the birds that visit your backyard. And here with me to chat about it is Daryl Jones. He's an urban ecologist and Professor Emeritus at Griffith University. He's also a real bird guy. He once live streamed his bird feeder. And Ewan Ritchie is a Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University and a member of the Biodiversity Council. Daryl, Ewan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Good morning.
We will get into bird flu in a tick, but I have to know about the birds in your backyard. Daryl, what birds visit you?
Well, this is a big topic, because if we're talking about the birds in my backyard featured in my feeder, that was when I lived in Brisbane. I now live in the middle of Melbourne, which is very different altogether.
Okay.
The birds that I would have got in my place in Brisbane would have started with rainbow lorikeets instantly, and then followed by pale-headed redellas who didn't get a chance when those big bullies were in the place. And if I'm lucky, king parrots and eastern redellas as well.
Eastern redellas, don't get me started singing. Ewan, how about your feeder? Or do you have one?
I don't have a bird feeder. I do put water out for wildlife, including birds, but also other animals as well. But I don't currently have a bird feeder out.
Who visits your backyard?
All sorts of wonderful wildlife. I also live in Melbourne too, and we're lucky enough to have gang cockatoos, king parrots, yellow-tailed black cockatoos in our street, which is not too bad for the burbs of Melbourne.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. My backyard is home to many, many, many king parrots. The first couple that you see are beautiful. When there's about five or six or seven of them, it starts to feel a bit like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. So, Daryl, you've written an article sort of highlighting the risk of feeding birds in our backyard. What are your concerns?
Yeah, this is a really serious issue, and it's really hard, isn't it? Because I used to be in the anti-feeding brigade. I would have told everybody that you're silly to feed the birds, and they'd all die of starvation when you stopped, and all those sorts of myths. It's not true. What we're concerned about is the fact that we do something really unnatural. We concentrate all a whole a bunch of birds coming to one place every day. Like if you put our food on a tray or something, the birds will come and feed on it every day because it'll be regular. And that's a very unusual in the bird world, because once they've used up all the seeds in the one patch or the fruit on the tree or whatever, they fly on to the next place. Whereas we've said, no, you don't need to do that anymore. You can come to this location singly, a single location every day, and lots of birds. And if any of them, it doesn't matter whether they've got bird flu, if any of them are sick, this is the perfect place for them to spread. So our advice now is to, how can we minimise the contact between the birds? Going back to the COVID days, remember what we had to keep away from one another, because that was the simplest way to do it.
You're worried that a bird feeder could be like a super spreader event.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the problem. I mean, it's you don't have to, you can imagine how it would happen. These birds come and squabble over the seeds that we've put down or something. And if any of them are sick, this is the perfect place for them to spread it. And that's what we're trying to prevent people from doing. So although I have been now advocating how to feed birds properly with all the right sort of food and all that sort of thing, I'm now saying, please, just at the moment, let's not do it again. If you care about the birds, and we now know that many of the people out there who do feed the birds do really care about them, the best way to care about them, stop feeding if you can.
Ewan, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, it's great that people have this wonderful connection with our extraordinary birds in Australia, but there are very few things that we can do right now, unfortunately, to keep wildlife safe from bird flu. But this is something practical that we can do. So I think, unfortunately, stopping bird feeding right now is a really sensible piece of advice.
Yeah, it's pretty sad if that's something that's part of your routine. Talk to me about what the sort of, we've had a couple of significant developments over the past week with bird flu, Ewan.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, we've now seen obviously bird flu spread into mammals, long-nosed fur seals. And we know from around the world that when bird flu gets into marine mammals, the impacts can be devastating. So we saw over 13,000 elephant seal pups die last summer in Heard Island. And that is just a catastrophic loss of numbers for any wildlife population. And that will have long-term impacts as well on their genetics and therefore their ability to withstand other threats and challenges that they might have in the future. So we've seen obviously over 300 cases now of bird flu in Australia, and that spreads from Western Australia right across the bottom of Southern Australia and up as far as Queensland. And in fact, there was a shearwater that was found with bird flu yesterday, which is a wide-ranging species that often occurs in large numbers. And so that's quite concerning that it's now appearing to pop up in shearwaters. And it's also moving inland. So there's reports of bird flu, you know, around the Murray River region and Mildura and those areas. So we would expect that bird flu is going to spread. And unfortunately, of course, as many of us know, we're coming into spring when many animals, including birds, often congregate to breed. And when we see large numbers of animals congregating, that means disease can spread more easily. So we're really concerned about what the next few months might hold for Australia's wildlife.
And the mammal death that we saw, the long-nosed fur seal in South Australia, how significant is that?
It's really significant. Obviously, it's tragic for one individual when they die, but of course what we're most concerned about is population-level effects. And in particular in South Australia, we have the Australian sea lion, which is an endangered species. We think there's about 12,000 individuals left in total, and there's been a large outbreak of bird flu around Kangaroo Island, and the pages, as they're called, and that is a significant breeding area for this species. And if that got into the Australian sea lion population and we saw the sort of, you know, numbers of deaths that we've seen for other marine mammal populations, that could absolutely drive this species towards extinction.
Yeah, really worrying. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Ewan Ritchie, who's a Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University, and Professor Emeritus Daryl Jones from Griffith University. We're talking about backyard bird feeders, what you probably think of as being a fairly wholesome and nice thing to do, but the risk of them being super spreader spots for bird flu, which is now spreading in Australia. I'm really interested to know about the birds that you love in your backyard, if you've got names for them, if you've got photos of them. One says, I have two king parrots who visit Prince and Princess. Another says, Deb says, bell birds have invaded my backyard and have pushed out all the smaller ones that I love. Even the bigger birds get mobbed and hounded away. Tried a super soaker attack. I don't know how to get rid of them. Daryl, any advice for Deb there?
This is a little bit outside my realm, getting rid of them. I don't want to get rid of them. but what the, you know, Life Matters is all about relationships. And I can just imagine all the people out there now who are going to be, it's a good news story, actually. All the people out there who have got magpie families, every second person I meet who knows what I do tells me about their magpies, how they come and bring their kids each year and all that sort of thing. The good news for them is they're the sorts of birds that probably won't get affected by this because they are so territorial that they keep everybody else away and they don't want to mix with anybody else. It's the birds that mix freely with each other, those that occur and breed often, as Ewan just said, in these big colonies, they're the ones we're really worried about. For some reason, I don't know really why. Do you know about this, Ewan, that we're really worried, the authorities are really worried about black swans because they seem to be particularly susceptible. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, that's right. From what I understand about black swans, information about their genetics and their immune function suggests that they don't have the same, I guess, resilience that other swan species have. And so there has been some work that's done before the arrival of bird flu in Australia, and black swans have been identified as a species that's at really high risk.
So on the text line, a couple of people are asking, and I might put this one to you, Ewan, because you said you put out water for wildlife. Yeah. People asking about bird baths, whether they are also dangerous.
Look, they are potentially, and Daryl's done a great job online, including for the Biodiversity Council, putting out great advice about how to reduce the risk. And essentially, just like with bird feeding, we don't recommend bird feeding, but water is really important, and we're coming into summer. And so animals do need water in our environment. And so the best thing we can do, of course, is just to make sure that those areas are kept really clean. And ideally, if you had more than one water dish. So whenever you're having large numbers of animals congregating in the one spot, that's more of a risk. Whereas if you have the luxury, you know, where your home is, to have several, you know, bird baths and areas of water for animals, that means that you're not having them all coming to the one location at the one time. And the other thing, of course, is to make sure that water is available at ground level for things like skinks, as well as, you know, above ground for many birds that might not want to come down to the ground and where they might be more vulnerable to things like feral cats or cats that are allowed to roam. So if we keep those water dishes clean, the risk is relatively low. So I think, you know, we don't want to discourage people putting out water for birds and wildlife over summer, because we think we're coming into a really nasty El Nino this year as well. And so I imagine water is going to be really important for species.
Well, Daryl Ewan, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom today. Ewan Ritchie, Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University, a member of the Biodiversity Council, and Daryl Jones, Urban Ecologist and Professor Emeritus at Griffith University. And thank you for telling me about your birds. One says, I put out a bird bath on my tiny Melbourne CBD balcony. Pigeons, of course, they're cute and smart, but also a passing wattle bird, ravens, this weekend a pair of currawongs. I put out some nesting material and saw the currawongs rummaging through and breaking some of the sticks to take away. And another says, at the moment I'm watching a large mob of fat female bowerbirds feeding. Two eagles out my kitchen window in the gorge, floating in the drifts. I'm lucky to be surrounded by the most beautiful country in Neyengala and never feel a need to feed the native wildlife. Watch, but don't touch. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, earlier in the show, you told me your beautiful stories of auntie and unclehood. When journalist and author Kate Lever became an auntie to her nieces, she said she learned a profound lesson about love and whether she wants kids of her own.
Do you know what? I hadn't given it a lot of thought, mainly because it's so dependent on someone else's life choices. You know, I had to wait until my sister was ready to have children herself. And I was kind of preoccupied, I think, you know, because of social conditioning and expectations and all of that. I just always deeply assumed that I would become a mum, because it's just sort of something a lot of people do. And so it wasn't till I think I was in my early 30s and I realized I didn't want to go along that route. And then my sister, bless her, got pregnant. And I was like, hang on a second. Now this could really work for me. And it's not something I think I'd sort of thought, yeah, I guess one day I'll become an auntie when my sister does her thing. But then I realized that being an auntie could be like a much bigger and more important and more central role for me than I'd ever sort of realized before. And that's meant a lot for me, because, you know, I think I went to stay with my sister when she had her second. So there was a newborn and a toddler in the house. And anyone who's experienced that knows it's complete mayhem. Mm. And my sister sort of said to me, does this make you more sure than ever that you've made the right decision not to have kids? And I know what she meant, because, you know, the house was a mess. It was loud. But I knew about all of that already. I'd thought about that in great detail. But I said yes, but it was more because, and I said this to her, it's more because the only thing I've worried about in not becoming a parent myself is that I am a very loving person and I do love children, you know. My first job was being a professional fairy, a children's entertainer. I've always loved children, and there's something very childlike about me. And I just said to my sister that day, you know, now I know where to put all my love.
That's Kate Lever, a journalist, author, and doting auntie to two amazing nieces, chatting to me earlier in the show. I do recommend going back and copying a listen of that one if you've got time to search for Life Matters on ABC Listen. You also sent me more beautiful auntie and uncle texts than I could possibly read in time. So here's a couple of them now. My first niece, says one, was born with seven mothers. Her mother was the eldest of eight girls. How she was loved and indulged. Another says, in West Arnhem Land, our language makes a distinction between aunties and uncles on our mother's and father's side. Our mother's oldest sister is called Morla, no English equivalent, with our mother's youngest sisters being called the equivalent of the word for mum. Our father's sisters translate in English to auntie. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the power of green spaces. There's been a new Scottish study showing that woodlands in urban areas are linked to lower use of antidepressants. What more could we do here in Australia to give city dwellers better access to the restorative effects of the bush? Plus, our resident philosopher, Patrick Stokes, will be in to help solve your moral dilemmas. That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.